I think the amount of guilt and the sense of alienation that people feel that when they fall in love with someone who's outside, and the struggle that they have to undergo to explain that choice, which they fully don't understand themselves, is a very deep conflict that my work tries to capture. And I think that the title of my book is Intimacy in Alienation. And alienation is something that is really very pregnant in the identities of these individuals who feel like aliens to their own community, because their community cannot imagine that why are they seeing the other as something positive, but not as how the community wants them to see. So there's a big gap that often gets deeper and it widens, and it really forecloses any conversation and imagination.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Ashish Roy. Dr. Roy is a psychoanalyst at the Delhi chapter of the Indian Psychoanalytic Society, and we discuss his new book entitled Intimacy in Alienation, a Psychoanalytic Study of Hindu-Muslim Relationships. And while our focus is on current state India and Indian-Muslim relationships there, The models that we unpack apply to all of us everywhere. The temptations of malignant othering, which is basically what he describes, is pervasive. But we focus on the Indian situation and address the past and the feeders and the historical moments that are the kernels of these antagonisms. He touches upon the riots in 2002, which he will describe for us, and of course, behind that, the 1947 partition and the atrocities associated with that. He undertakes a very challenging effort in this book, and he says that transcending the binary of us them, into a third, a creative third, he says, is essential, quote, in the quest for newer foundations, defining Hindu and Muslim identities that are freed from historically entrenched definition. We talk about the third and the establishment of a third. He shares with us his research methodology, which is quite interesting, where it's not just survey gathering. He feels that he, as the interviewer, becomes a transference object quite similar to what happens in the clinical setting. And he, being an analyst, is very attuned to that and notes also how the repetition plays out with him as it does in other areas of the individual's lives. We talk about the importance of family support in helping Hindu-Muslim marriages survive. And more often than not, he describes how that family support is lacking. He shares with us the temptation, the fundamentalist temptation, to see people in these simplified terms of oppressor, oppressed. And he makes a plea for us to be able to move beyond that. He does close by bemoaning the erosion of the narratives of harmony, as he calls it, but does see his work as a small but meaningful effort to remedy that. It's an important conversation for all of us. And I give you my discussion with Dr. Ashish Roy. Ashish, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you. We know that the process of mentally endowing the other with characteristics that are considered filthy enables the accuser to claim the attributes of purity, if not godliness. In your work, you demonstrate that a version of this malignant othering is alive and well on the edges of the Hindu-Muslim interface. Now, to be sure, the list of various ethnicities that both in the past and certainly currently are assigned these characteristics of existential dirtiness is lengthy indeed. Your research is specific to the Hindu-Muslim world in India today. But this is true for all of us. This is true for all the ages. This is true for everyone. Wherever we are, the other is around us and within us. We know that trauma is intergenerationally transmitted, but so too is this othering phenomenon. And I've been interested in the paucity of the literature, especially the professional literature, on the intergenerational impact of the 1947 partition between India and Pakistan, a whirlwind of rape, murder, and displacement. There's mostly been silence, certainly in the professional literature, but also, as I understand it, in the community, from the next two generations who were and are so impacted by those horrors. And I see your work as existing in the shadows of this calamity. And we're going to discuss this further when we talk about your background and how you got interested in this work, the meaning of the 2002 riots, etc. But I'd like to start us off by reading from your introduction, which sets up the theme of the book. You write, "I began this project wondering if this bond of the couple can offer the larger collective an insight into enduring differences, coexistence, and desire for the other, with an imagination of the future. Threat can be accessed in the fundamentalist national imagination, where the existence of the erotic between Hindus and Muslims is unthinkable. It is perceived as a threat to the purity of one community. You write that this book is an attempt to offer different possibilities of imagining and preserving mutual Hindu-Muslim intimacy. You go on to say the desire for the other is situated in the in-between space of the prejudiced way of understanding the other and the otherness of the other that seeks recognition. There is a quest for newer foundations defining Hindu and Muslim identities that are freed from historically entrenched definitions." That's quite a goal, and that's quite an introduction. Ashish, you want to start us off?
Thank you, Harvey, for having me talk about my book. I think this is a rare enterprise of looking at the bond in the Hindu-Muslim couple and trying to think about the conflicts and the strengths in that bond and what can we learn from that. And how can we think about it when we think about the history and the future of the two communities? And as you have already mentioned, that you are aware of the violent past that the two communities have had. And today, that violence gets reinforced in many ways with different agendas. And I wanted to see that what happens to that violence in the space of love, which must also exist between a couple, even if they belong to different communities? And does that love translate the violence and give it a new meaning? Or does the love drown in the violence, which is always readily accessible? So my work actually is about relooking and revisiting how we understand the other, thinking whether Hindus and Muslims are actually an other to each other, or did they have a different way of imagining coexistence? So different generations in our country have different narratives, and the narratives in this book also belong to a different generation. I think that this work is, neither is it about the forgetting of the other as the other, and at the same time, there is a need to preserve the new recognition of the other that gets created in the Hindu-Muslim couple. So this work doesn't take the position that there has only been love between Hindus and Muslims, and neither does it take the position that there has only been hatred. I see both these positions as split positions, and this work is about preserving those splits, but also imagining a different future.
You write, speaking of the remedy, historically predetermined otherness finds its own distinctive meaning within the relational bond. While Kakar, and this refers to Sitir Kakar, who you reference throughout the book, and I had the opportunity to interview not long before he died, you write, while Kakar puts forth the negative impressions of otherness which color Hindu-Muslim relationships, this study is about the psychological negotiation of these negative images and the creation of the positive impressions of otherness, which are found within the intimate couple and, in fact, often facilitate the intimacy. Tell us about how it may facilitate the intimacy.
I would just like to say that Sudhir Kakkar brought in to Indian psychoanalysis the fact that the group is a very strong presence, and he defined it as the VR of identity. So you can't think of the individual without thinking of the group. And this becomes even more prominent in the Hindu-Muslim dyad, where the group already has its own history through which it looks at the relationship. At the same time, Kakkar also saw Hindus and Muslims as defining each other, as seeing each other as the other. At least he saw that with clarity when he thought about Hindus perceiving themselves. I also write about another writer, Intizar Hussain, who was able to see and come to a formulation that he could feel both like a Hindu and a Muslim. And I think that it's important to preserve the birth of that mixed identity that he was able to preserve in his work. So unfortunately, we don't have too many images of the positive impressions of otherness that can facilitate the Hindu-Muslim bond. In this work, in most of my couples, all the men are Muslim and their partners are Hindu. This work shows us that Muslim men are secular, extremely feminine, caring, and standing with their partners in situations where the rest of the family has perhaps withdrawn or is not able to give the kind of recognition that the partner requires. And I think that is a sense of the other that is really missing today, where Muslim men are usually villainized and seen as being extremely fierce and dominating, wanting to control Hindu women, especially if we look at the discourse of love jihad, which I mention in this book. So we don't have an imagination of what is positive about the other. And this book, through the different narratives, really tries to create that and preserve that while upholding the narrative of the couple.
That's an important observation. We don't have a narrative about what is positive about the other, which also reflects some trouble with the positivity in oneself that would form the basis of being able to honor it in the other. You speak about loyalty to one's group and one's family as either contributing to or conflicting with this remedy of love, if you will. You write, although we usually understand the male-female relationship as being the primary relationship through which we mediate the world, Erikson, who you also quote throughout the book, brings to our notice the primacy of the adult-child relationship that coexists with the male-female relationship. And you add that you would like to add that the individual is also born into class, caste, and religion, which are transmitted by one's primary relationship. Again, Kakar expresses something similar. He writes, given the strong family and kinship ties all over the country, a Hindu's enmity towards the Muslim, and vice versa, is often experienced by the individual as part of the loyalty due to, or in the case of a more conflicted parent-child relationship, imposed by the parents. That's the loyalty to one's kinship, to the clan. How do you see that?
Well, I think that it's a loyalty that both men and women feel very strongly, especially when they fall in love with somebody who's outside their community. And communities in India can be defined through caste and through religion. And my work focuses only on religion. And I think the amount of guilt and the sense of alienation that people feel that when they fall in love with someone who's outside, and the struggle that they have to undergo to explain that choice, which they fully don't understand themselves, is a very deep conflict that my work tries to capture. And I think that the title of my book is Intimacy in Alienation. And alienation is something that is really very pregnant in the identities of these individuals who feel like aliens to their own community, because their community cannot imagine that why are they seeing the other as something positive, but not as how the community wants them to see. So there's a big gap that often gets deeper and it widens, and it really forecloses any conversation and imagination. So the couple has to find its own resources to give meaning to its relationship, to its identity. And that's a very, very tough path that most couples have to take.
Remind me, among the couples that you interviewed and are represented in the book, do any have supportive families?
Yes. Many of them have supportive families, but the support is present in different degrees. So in some of the couples, the support is more like a respect, that we respect that you have made this choice, but we can't fully give you the kind of love that we would have given you if you had married somebody from the same religion. With some, the degree of support comes into play when the child is born, and the child for the grandparents is a new form of, is a way of forgetting the past. But the child is also carrying his own untranslated question of being the parents of a Hindu-Muslim couple, which the society is going to ask him at some point of time, that which religion do you belong to? So in my observations, support is not something that you get for granted. You have to really work hard to be able to achieve it and to maintain those ties. But the beginning is often with a kind of an alienation or an abandonment.
If the child is not raised in the one of the religious backgrounds of the mother or father and their respective families, is that child accepted by the other religious family?
I think the child really represents a lot of hope. The child is a new representation of who the couple is. So the child does receive a lot of love, and maybe the child also perhaps allows for the creation of a kind of a balm to the angst and the upset and the conflict that may occur between the couple and the family. So I do think that the child becomes a representation of a new life.
We're going to get to some of what you've written about the child, very much in accord with what you said. Before we get there, I want to ask you about what you call negative identity. And let me read what you wrote about it. Again, it's from Erickson. You write, "The negative identity is that identity which has been denied by everyone and yet remains most real, the presence of the negative in identity. It is a part of the self that remains unthought and disavowed, but has been deposited in the self by the community. Erickson's illustration of the negative identity covers a range of individuals. In one clinical illustration, he describes how when a mother is unable to mourn the loss of her dead child, the living child's identity is marked by wanting to be dead, rather than being recognized as being alive. The mother's unmourned loss turns into a negative identity for the child, and he does not feel desired for being alive by his mother. Desire for oneself is related to how one is desired by one's family and community. Erickson's negative identity shows us the desire to be recognized can be so strong that one can be pushed to negative extremes to seek recognition." What's striking in that quote is the absence of the father and how he may offer the child an alternative model besides the mother's deadness. But that's for another time, perhaps. How does the negative identity issue live in the you put it in the section of communality. Help us see how that's part of the community.
Well, in India, most Hindu women are told that you can marry anyone, but don't marry a Muslim.
Let me quote that sentence again. I don't know if you intended it to be comedic, but you can marry anyone as long as it's not a Muslim. Yeah. So you can't marry anyone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, at times this is articulated very clearly, but at times it's also like an unsaid inscription that women carry. And I think that women articulate it more, but men also carry it. So for a Hindu woman in many parts of India, especially North India, which is where most of my reflections come from, marrying a Muslim would be a negative thing. So the desire to marry someone that your community disavows, the desire to marry someone about whom your community has no positive imagination is a negative desire. That's how it's shaped.
Mm-hmm.
That is one part of it. The other is also that my work also looks at ways in which individuals can receive a huge sense of non-recognition, that they themselves are psychologically pushed to extremes, to a sense of alienation, that you are turning into someone that we just cannot recognize. And that, when that kind of a process gets more intensified and you marry someone who your community disapproves of, then you really have nowhere to go. But I would like to add that even though I use Erickson's work on identity, I think identity is a very powerful culmination of certain choices that stand completely opposite to what the community wants. So I think that my work is also about looking at many of those psychological self-states, alienated identifications, and pre-subject positions that individuals carry before they arrive at an identity. So although I refer to Erickson and I found his work to be very helpful, I also focus a lot on the precursors to the development of an identity.
And you mean that other than how the family and community views the child? Because those two contribute to the pre-identity constellation.
Yes. So I really try to show the ways in which the conflict with the group and the conflict within the relationships and the family all get at times enmeshed or blended. And what does that do to the life of the couple who are forging this new identity between the two of them?
Tell us about what you call love jihad.
The discourse on love jihad forecloses any imagination around the Hindu-Muslim couple. This discourse refuses to see Hindu-Muslim love as being born out of willingness and agency. Further, it re-emphasizes the prejudiced perception of the Muslim male as being predatory and sees the Hindu woman as being asexual and without desire. The genesis of this discourse is based on the disavowal and misrecognition of desire. It pressurizes the Hindu-Muslim couple to find forms of desire that are not forms of revenge. So love jihad is a discourse which is extremely prevalent in the country today, and different states are forming laws which quote-unquote prevent love jihad from taking place. But it doesn't allow one to see a Hindu and a Muslim falling in love as being a democratic act, and forces people to see it as an act of coercion or force. And in some ways, it goes back to this fantasy or history of one community trying to take over another community. And it evokes all those fears of what will happen if Muslims are going to take over Hindus. And it doesn't allow the Hindu-Muslim couple to talk about themselves in any other way. And I think that the Hindu-Muslim couple today are also many a times responding to how their relationship is not love jihad, but there's an absence of a language to give themselves a recognition outside of this discourse. And that is a big struggle that they have to keep on explaining that this is not how we fell in love. But I also feel that it's some kind of a responsibility and also a big challenge for the couple to try and create a new language through which they would like to be known, a language which preserves the confluence of the two identities. And at the same time, I think that they should also have the freedom to say that in this space of our relationship, I'm not Hindu and not Muslim. I don't remember my religion. So at times, religion is also so pregnant with its own meanings that it can be severely impinging, and people are forced to confine themselves to certain meanings.
You know, listening to your description of the binary mindset of you are a this and you are a that, and that defines all that is to be understood about each of you and both of you, it sounds so similar to some of the ways of thinking in the West here, where instead of Muslim-Hindu fundamentalism, there's oppressor-oppressed fundamentalism, and all nuance and history and psychology are collapsed into these simplified models of human relations. And your example, you know, I spoke at the beginning and we're speaking about Hindu Muslims, but this applies worldwide. And in the West, it's not so much religions that are turned to for definition, but these concepts, as I said, of who's on top and who's on bottom. And yes, finding a new language, a language that actually listens to the internal experience of each of the parties, seems certainly a worthwhile effort, shall we say. Let's talk about your research. It is fascinating. I'll say it's controversial. And let me borrow your overview of it, and then I'll ask you about it. And it's about the use and understanding of transference in a research setting. You write, Being aware of the transference allows the unlived parts of the individual to find form. Transference makes the relationship between the therapist and the patient more important than the symptom and the treatment. With the emphasis on transference, the psychoanalytic orientation facilitates the experiencing and living out of intimacies, which may not have been lived out elsewhere within the context of care. It is through the transferential relationship in which different forms of absence find representation that we arrive at the unknown parts of the self. Drawing from the model of transference, this work will focus on the relationship between the researcher and the participant as a context in which the internal world of the participant finds representation as the unthought and unprocessed mysteries of the internal world find form in the research process. And you refer to Christopher Bolas, who writes, "The analyst has to become an object for the patient, someone who can be used so that the unthought elements of his own character find expression." And you write, "In this work, I attempt to extend these concepts to the research field. It is a bold effort. Why don't you walk us through your thinking about it and how well you feel it succeeded or not, the limitations of it, the advantages, etc.?"
Thank you for bringing our attention to this part. Well, firstly, I must say that it was a task to create a framework through which I could look at the internal worlds of the individual and the couple, and at the same time include the researcher as a methodological object and not just as a impersonal objective participant. And to extend the psychoanalytic ethic of the analyst being involved in the patient while being conscious of one's own subjective involvement, what Erickson called as a disciplined subjectivity, I think that it was important for me to use some of those ideas to think of what is happening between me and the participant, because I was interviewing them over years and there was a passage of time and I was with some of my participants trying to see that how are they experiencing me as a researcher? What are their expectations from me? What are their fantasies? And can I use that to understand their fantasies and expectations with the significant others who they are talking about? So I use the transference as a model to observe patterns of relating between the researcher and the participant, and then to throw light on how the participant is relating to the objects. In some of the psychobiographies, these patterns have been outlined. And it was important for me to see that there's a repetition which was happening. And the repetition allowed me to bring these observations to light. Within the framework of the study, I observed significant relationships in their lives. How did they understand breakdowns in relationships, traumatic events, childhood experiences, patterns of relating in their intimate relationships? What were the fantasies of commitment that individuals have? Exploration of violent events, if there were any. Religious identifications, and how did they process them? Were there shades of alienation in their own lives?
Let me ask you about this. What you're doing is you're mapping the meaning you had to these individuals as a researcher with the experience they would have if they were in analysis with you. You've conducted clinical analyses, you've been in your own as an analyst. You must notice that there are also differences, yeah? How would you characterize what's different about it, not so much what's similar?
I think the difference is that in analysis, you give the symptom a life, what Freud called as a transference neurosis, and then the symptom occupies the room, it occupies the analyst, the analyst's internal world. Over here, the person is talking about this issue knowing that he's talking to a psychologist. So I think that the narrative in itself gets shaped by the fact that you're talking to someone who has a psychological sensibility. And there is also not only the need to talk about oneself in a guarded or an intellectualized way, but there's also a need to communicate that parts of me require healing. And that's where I thought that me as a psychotherapist, as a psychoanalyst, was getting drawn into and was drawing things from the participants. So my position was as a psychologist and as a researcher. So I can't forget the fact that they also saw me as a psychologist.
I hear you. Let me shift focus. There's a section you have that I'm very fond of. It's about the social third. You write that the social and cultural third, which preserve the complexity of the internal and external world, and also the psychosocial perspective. Thirdness represents a space within psychoanalysis that allows for an engagement between what happens in the clinic and in the social processes. These directions epitomize Freud's idea that the neurosis in the patient being witnessed in the clinic also represents the neurosis in the society. In defining the psychosocial perspective, Stephen Frosch and Lisa Baritzer emphasize that psychosocial studies is interested in the interplay between what are conventionally thought of as external social and internal psychic formations, resulting in a turn to psychoanalysis as the discipline that might offer convincing explanations for how the out there gets in here and vice versa. Again, how the out there gets in here and vice versa. I think it's a wonderful way to describe it. Can you say what that means to you and how it influenced your way of approaching this work?
Well, I would like to mention that I was really inspired by Neil Altman's work on race from his book, The Analyst in the Inner City, in which he writes about his interaction with an African-American patient who he calls Mr. A, and how the conflict over not paying fee became also a transference, counter-transference situation in which their own identities as being white and as being African-American got activated. And I think that is what Neil Altman calls as a social third, that there you are not in a consulting room which is free of these meanings. And it was heartening for me to see the honesty with which this interaction was described and the way it was being thought about. And I used that to think about the different elements that the couples are not able to completely formulate between themselves, which I call as fragments, which require a canvas so that they can be seen and held before they can be given any recognition. And I feel that culturally there's an absence of representations of thirdness where they can see that they themselves have broken halves, like we have spoken about in this interview earlier, that their own identity is something which requires a translation, a formulation for themselves. So how do they explain to the world what they cannot explain completely to themselves? And the world is not helping them give too much meaning to their love or to their desire. So for me, thirdness also becomes an absence that the couple does not have in terms of cultural narratives, in terms of familial narratives. And this work is a representation of thirdness where hopes, confusions, and the future can all be kept together.
It's a distance from the literalness of the binary. You're either this or that, and allows for a creative opportunity, is what I understand you to be saying. Is that right?
Yes, it's a distance, and it's also a way in which the different layers which are interacting, the intersubjective, the intrapsychic, the interpersonal, and the group can be put together, which is where I think that Altman's work on looking at the social third, which is borrowing from Ogden's work on looking at the analytic third, is very important, that you don't lose the relevance and the nuances of the intersubjective and the interpersonal, but you also bring in the fact that there is a very strong social reality which is very much a part of this interaction.
And how one parses that out from the intrapsychic space is certainly a challenge that we're all trying to understand, the how it overlaps and how it is distinguished from. You go on, speaking of thirds, and this is where you write about the couple and the child. You say, the couple is also dependent upon the group, especially with their offspring being a symbol of a continuation of the couple's relationship within the group. The couple draws upon the group's generative potential and feels as if the group enables the life of the couple through the birth of the child. The child is a symbol of thirdness that is created out of the couple and carries the hope for a better future. The recognition of this symbol by the older generation in the context of Hindu-Muslim marriages holds a special significance because this child represents a fusion of the Hindu and the Muslim community, which has been historically and socially resisted. A positive recognition by the older generation would mean a change in the way that the discontinuity between Hindu-Muslims has been imagined. That's the healing. That's the remedy in the concrete existence of the child, but that only works, of course, if the child is endowed with an actual thirdness, not yet another arena to fight the old battle through, yeah?
Yeah, I think that if we look at one of the psychobiographs of Sunaina and Kasim, whose son is called Suhail, and the couple themselves have a very secular upbringing. But in one of the instances that was shared with me, it was told to me that the father, who's a Muslim, doesn't like to go to the mosque. But on the day of Eid, the son wants to wear the skull cap and go to the mosque. So there's an identification which doesn't have a space for it to be nurtured and looked at. The father wants to perhaps move away from religion, and the son still wants to have an association with religion. So that is one instance where I got a sense of something that the father wants to alienate from himself, because religion in itself becomes such a negative thing. You really want to protect yourself from it, because it only exists as a binary, unfortunately. That if you are practicing as a Muslim, then you're not practicing as a Hindu. And of course, there are many other strands of understanding this, because we've also had a very major Sufi culture in our country, and a lot of music in the country often professes that. But it's difficult for the couple to find tangible ways of translating it into practice and living, because religion involves practice. So it was interesting for me to see that and to imagine that how will this desire for the son to still want to be a Muslim like his father, and identification with his father, and his father's sense that I want to move away from this religious identification, how is it going to play out later on? And the other problem is that the rest of the society, once the son steps into school, is going to ask that, are you a Muslim or are you a Hindu? That confusion is not a very, it's not a very comfortable confusion. It doesn't have a recognition. Like today, I think that this is not a very well-researched thought, but I think that in urban setups, perhaps there is more awareness of young people having a bisexual identity. But I'm not sure if there is as much comfort as having, you know, a bi-religious identity.
Yeah. Is there a grandfather available for the son to go to the mosque with?
Yes, I think that in the, from what I remember, the grandfather was available. But the point is that he wanted to go with his father.
Right.
He didn't want his father to forget his own religious identification.
Let me ask you to read a paragraph from your conclusion on page 171.
Looking back, this study began with a personal quest to understand the encounter with prejudice in the way one thinks about the other. As one acknowledged the hatred behind such prejudiced ways of thinking, there was a desire to explore alternative ways of knowing through the love of and for the other. This desire transformed into looking into shades of otherness within the interpersonal context of Hindu-Muslim intimacy. Intizar Hussain's evocation of syncretism, "I am a Muslim, but I feel there is a Hindu sitting inside me," is a profound challenge to such prejudice. In psychoanalysis, internal objects within the self mediate one's good and bad experiences. It made me realize the need of a cultural object, an amalgam that could capture different ways of being Hindu and Muslim. This would preserve the space for these identities to be forgotten and refound, with the hope that it would help in facilitating intimacy between two communities. In retrospect, this work was guided by the need to create such an object.
So beautifully said. And let me ask you about your journey, your past. You and I have spoken a bit about it, but why don't you share it with the listener? What drew you to this search to create this new object?
Well, it was a very strange moment of awareness when I was sitting in a mental asylum observing deeply psychotic and schizophrenic patients as a part of my training. And one of those patients happened to be a Muslim patient, which one could identify because he was wearing a skull cap. And the other patients around me were having visual hallucinations. And suddenly, three of us, me as an observer and two of the patients, just stopped. And we were looking at this Muslim patient who was very unwell. And one of the schizophrenic patients next to me said that he's a Muslim. And now look at the way he's going to eat. And soon there will be flies. And the other patient who was having visual hallucinations became completely normal and started looking at the Muslim patient as well. And I was shocked that if madness is a space where you suspend reality and go into another world, here madness has been suspended and you are completely taken up by this religious other who has given you a saner identity in some ways. So I thought that in that moment, those patients had become less mad because they had started looking at this patient as being Muslim. And when I wrote about this in my dissertation, I started thinking that, why did I see him as a Muslim? Why did I join this experience? And I couldn't think of my parents ever telling me that Muslims are like this, or they ever saying anything which was politically quote unquote right. And so I was struck that why am I feeling like this? And I wanted to explore that experience. That's why recognition of prejudice and hatred of the other are central components to this work. And that's why this work occupies a very strange space, because it's not a secular work. Because most secular ideals don't allow you to think about the fact that you can also hate the other. But if you want to transform that hatred, what do you have to do? So I feel that that was the beginning of the work. And then I wanted to see that in the space of the couple, does this awareness of otherness, does it rattle the couple? Does it create a conflict? What does it do? So I think it's been a huge journey for me to learn so much about Muslim men through my participants. And they have all left such a strong impression it's been a journey to find out that for someone, you can be introduced to Islam when you're very young and your parents take an active interest in introducing you to all kinds of diversity. But when you want to marry a Muslim man, they don't understand how that desire got evoked in you. So I think that I have learned so much and there is so much to learn because the two religions are different and the faiths are different and they've had very interesting histories. So I think it really is a very, very, it's an ongoing process.
Mm. Can you say something about the 2002 riots? First, explain to our listeners what they were and how that played a part in your development.
Well, the 2002 riots are a deeply sensitive and complicated issue. There were riots that took place in Godhra, which is a place in Gujarat. And there are different narratives about how the riots started. But there was a train that got burnt. That train, the Sabarmati Express. Right now, I'm not fully aware of how it got burnt, but a story was created that it was Muslims who had targeted that train. And as a revenge, the Muslim community in that particular part of Gujarat was targeted for a very, very long time. And some very violent crimes were committed. Many of those cases are still ongoing. And at least in my generation, I think that was the first time you saw the kind of animosity and hatred that one community can have towards the other. And it left a very deep impression of how what had happened in the partition can happen all over again. I'm not sure if it was the return of the repressed, because I think that the partition as a subject is something that has been written about a lot, but I'm not sure how much it has been processed emotionally. And I think that's where psychoanalysis can play a huge role as a research method and as a way of thinking. But the horrors of the partition are very much alive. They get communicated through histories which are told in families, and they affect society in very, very deep ways. But I also don't want to say that all Hindu-Muslim couples have to provide answers to things as big as the partition, events as big as the partition. And it's not only on their shoulders to provide all the metaphors and processes of healing. So I would like to add that as well.
Sure. When you say it's been written about a lot, you don't mean in the psychoanalytic or psychology literature, or do you? Because I've looked and there's some, but not a great deal, given the enormity of the event.
It's been written a lot by historians, by sociologists.
Right, right. And is it part of cultural discourse? The comparison, perhaps too easy a comparison, is with the Holocaust in the West, where families and institutes and museums, legacies are discussed, and it is part of many people's lives that their parents, grandparents are survivors and how that affects them. Is that type of emotional engagement with a literacy of, is that part of the partitions living in India and Pakistan nowadays, or is it other than that?
At least in the way I received my education, I was actively taught that this is what the partition was, and this is the kind of violence that got evoked in people's minds. And I think some formidable writers like Saadat Hasan Manto, who wrote fiction and plays, some of their writing is to be understood only by those people who lived in that time. And it really captures the horror and the kind of psychological breakdown people underwent. And I make references to some of his stories. So I think I would be very surprised if in the Indian literary scene, if there are individuals who are not inspired by writers like that. But I must say that today there is definitely an erosion of the narratives of harmony, which you find only in the older generation who came from, who, you know, suffered the consequences of the partition. But those narratives are really far and few.
There's erosions of the narratives of harmony.
Yeah.
A troubling, heavy-spirited place for us to pause. But your book, your work, your interest, your thoughtfulness maybe can do something about that erosion. Again, the title of the book is Intimacy in Alienation, a Psychoanalytic Study of Hindu-Muslim Relationships. Ashish, I learned a great deal. Thank you for your work and thank you for sharing it with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Harvey. This has been a deeply enriching conversation. I genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.